Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. All right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and James Kovacevic. I had to pause there, James. I don't think I've introduced you in a while, so I had to had to think it through a little bit first. So welcome back. Welcome back to Speaking of Reliability.
Oh, thanks, Fred. It has been a while. I think we've both been on the road, and it's been difficult to make the times line up, but I'm glad we finally were able to.
That's right. You know, and we had just chatted before I hit record about a topic. I think I'm going to write another topic down, so we'll get you back here and talk about it. Is you're just back from PMAC, a Canadian-based maintenance conference, and you just mentioned that I think it was in next week. I think it's in St. Louis. Is you're heading to SMRP conference? Is that right?
Kansas City. But yeah. off in a week and a half to Kansas City for that.
Okay. Yeah, if customs will let you in. I understand that's always a fun adventure.
Yeah, going to present, typically there's no issues with anything like that. So that's always, that's the easy part.
Okay. Just as long as you're not closing deals and making money, taking jobs away from us Americans, right?
Exactly.
No. Well, have a good time at that conference. And by the time this airs, you'll be back from that. But there's a topic that I thought of earlier today, and this just reminded me of it, is, well, I mean, you tend to go to the maintenance conferences. You've talked about PMAC and about SMRP and about Reliability 2.0, and I think there's a handful of others you've mentioned and been going to. And I tend to talk about ARS, Applied Reliability Symposium, or RAMS, the Reliability and Maintainability Symposium, but you don't see that many maintenance people at RAMS. I was wondering, do you think there's value in going to conferences that are not advertised directly in your market, but to go to conferences that are tangential? So go to a medical reliability conference and, you know, stuff like that.
I do think there's some value in that. So I, like you mentioned, I typically attend the asset management type, maintenance reliability, asset management conferences, whereas you're more on the product reliability side.
That's right.
Now, they're related, but they're very different disciplines. And when I think about it, I could learn a lot by going to RAMS on different ways to approach problems that we're dealing with in asset management with a process, with a system. The tools and techniques are the same, but how you apply them could be different. And by going to RAMS, I think, one, it would open my eyes up to different things that are out there. Mm-hmm. But I also think it might depress me a little bit.
What, we don't know how to design products reliably? And you have to put up with it in the plant?
The effort that goes into the design phase of consumer products and stuff of that nature, you don't see that when you're typically talking about production equipment. For the most part, that level of rigor isn't involved.
Well, I don't know. I think Siemens and other, you know, these million-dollar pieces of equipment that are electromechanical marvels, in my opinion, those are not just, you know, slap it together and ship it to you. Those are pretty well engineered. They're complex. They're exceedingly complex. But even things like PLCs, and those things are industrialized. They're pretty solid. They're well designed, in my opinion. Maybe I'm coming to too much of a consumer electronics background.
I agree. If you take a typical PLC, whether it's Siemens, Allen Bradley, that is a robust machine. That is a robust part or system. Mm-hmm. What I'm referring to is more of that overall system, or the integration between the PLC, the motor, the mechanical systems, all that stuff.
Well, and they all come from different people, from different companies, right? And so it's the plant engineering that has to design all that stuff. And I agree there. Sometimes that's done by a consultant. They get it up, it runs once, and they're like, "Yep, there you go, good, we're out of here." And then you're on your own.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's where I'm coming from. I listen to Speaking of Reliability on a regular basis. And when I hear you guys about Halt and Haas and you know, reliability block diagrams and design FEMAs and all that. Those are all great things. And I would like to see more of that over in our realm of asset management.
Well, you know, to be fair, I attended Reliability 2.0 and a couple other asset management type conferences over the years, I agree it's similar concepts, slightly different set of constraints. That's kind of the way I'd phrase it. But thinking about asset management is really done much better in your world than in mine. When in my world, we call it life cycle costing. And it's just the cost of ownership kind of considerations. And in many organizations, even with repairable systems, that's not well thought out. It's get the design to function, get it to work. And then it's, well, the maintenance is out of our control. Whereas if you're at a factory and thinking through asset management and involved with the design part, you tie those two together very, very closely. And so I saw a number of papers that really made a case that that's the best practice type stuff. And it's, and it wasn't that difficult to do. It was a little bit of a change in mindset, but it involved asking the right questions up front. But the other part I get out of these conferences is just the conversations. We're all trying to solve the same problems, right?
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the best parts of these conferences is you're sitting at the table having breakfast or lunch with a couple other people, and you mention a problem that you're working through, and half the people at that table have the same problem.
Yeah. And they're in various stages of it at one point or another, right?
So you get different approaches on how to solve that problem, how to approach it, what they've done, what hasn't worked for them. So you get all that. But secretly inside, you're also like, thankfully, I'm not the only person dealing with this issue. It gives you that, okay, not special. Exactly.
Well, that's one aspect. And I don't know if you see it as a reliability engineer within in a factory or asset management. In product development teams, we're often the only reliability professional. And so within maintenance groups and maintenance programs, the teams that I've got the chance to work with, there were not that many reliability professionals around. There were plenty of maintenance folks and plenty of technicians and plenty of managers. And everybody was concerned about reliability, but they didn't know what to do about it. And then they'd hire the token reliability engineer. You know, and it was, I don't know. Do you see that it's a lonely job from the reliability perspective?
It is. You see, within the organizations I see, you have usually one reliability engineer for the site, or maybe a corporate reliability engineer that's trying to educate the sites on reliability techniques and topics.
Kind of grow their own reliability expertise.
Exactly. But typically, you know, aside from a few select organizations that I've had the privilege to work with, you are that standalone person. Like you said, there's a lot of expertise on maintenance, but the reliability end of it is a different story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they go hand in hand and they're different. They're completely different things though. Maintenance, reliability are different. And it is a lonely road sometimes, I would say, for that sole reliability engineer in a plant trying to keep all those assets running as they should.
That's right. And it's the same in product development. A reliability engineer may support, you know, two or three development programs and is going basically from meeting to meeting to meeting and then in the labs and then to vendors and dealing with field returns. And so the conference experience is getting to as many as you can, even if it's just the same one routinely, is you start to build those camaraderie. You know, what made me bring this up is that you mentioned at a table that you have a problem and realize everybody's had a similar problem or in it at the point. You aren't alone. And I think that's a big part of the professional societies, the conferences, the site like Ascendo, where we're trying to pull together professional development material and community. Those things all come from a point of, well, you're not alone. It isn't rocket science unless you work at one of the space companies or NASA or something like that. But even there, it's just reliability. We're trying to create things and keep them running and make them robust and those kinds of things. It's different sets of constraints. you know, in different factories. I'm quite sure that you've seen this. You go to a bottling plant and they have a problem, and you mention something that you saw, say, in a process industry, in, say, a petroleum plant. And they say, well, that works for them because they have oil and they have money and all this stuff. And that'll never work here. Kind of thing. You know, like, hey, look, you got pipes and valves and vats and pumps. You know, a pump is a pump. Yeah, they're moving, you know, explosive fuel, and you're moving Coca-Cola. We have similar problems here, guys.
Pumps are pumps. You're right. And, you know, all these things work together, and they're all typically relatively the same for the most part. But what's funny, though, is you mentioned that, well, that works in that industry, not this industry. And to some degree, I'm going to say that is true. Mm-hmm. To some degree, the techniques and tools will work. Does your culture or company resource it properly to make those techniques and tools work? I think that's the difference.
Well, you know, that varies by industry as well. There's, I think some industries are a little more advanced. And I used to think the medical industry had, you know, had the best culture because they were so regulated. Then I found out that reliability is a business risk. It's not a patient risk, as long as the product fails and the patient's not harmed, right? And so if your product only works 10% of the time, you can go to market with that. If it's effective that few times it works, you can go to market with it. They don't regulate the reliability of it. And that's a business decision. Whereas in an asset management world, if it's not working, somebody's going to tell you about it because it's, you're shutting down the plant, you're shutting down the line, you're impacting revenue. And so it's, I think there's a, different industries will see it in a different way, though, of what they're accustomed to as throughput and what maturity they have. But I think there's really, really good auto manufacturers, and there's really good plant bottlers, and there's really good cosmetic manufacturers, and all across the board. But equally, I think there's really bad ones, examples in every industry.
Absolutely. You have, it's like everything. You have your top performers and your lowest performers in every industry, every profession. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Isn't there a book out that, the bell, something about a bell, the bell-shaped curve, I think it is. I think that was actually a book. But you know, one part that I've always struggled with when I'm going back to conferences is that I remember when I was working at Hewlett-Packard, it was like one conference a year, unless the company was flush with money and they were being generous and said, oh, you can go to a second conference. But we could never justify a conference in Hawaii. You know, Orlando was the best we could do. But it was the return from going to get not only just the training and exposure to all these different topics and papers and so on, but the networking and the camaraderie and you're not alone kind of thing and building those relationships. There's people I've known only through conferences for 20 years. And they're my go-to people when I have I'm just completely stumped. Bill would know how to do this. Let me give him an email and give him a call. And it builds that network that
absolutely.
Is invaluable.
That is a huge, huge benefit. Try and justify that return or that benefit in financial terms, you might have a little bit of a problem. But it is a huge benefit. You can reach out to these people. You can ask these questions. You can get that great feedback, all because you sat down and had breakfast with them one day and maybe a beer with them at the networking thing at the end of the day. That's hugely beneficial. You get to share that knowledge, leverage expertise. Maybe he might have a question you can help him with.
That's right.
All those things are they're priceless, right?
They are. I think that's what makes, I think that's really what separates professionals from non-professionals is you're willing to ask for help. You're willing to build a team around something. You're willing to share what you know. I think it goes both ways. Some people are paying it back because they've been helped through their career. And others it's a way, we don't have apprenticeship programs and mentoring programs and things like that to take us through our careers. So the networking that we do in conferences is a big part of that, is a big piece of and I agree, the biggest value of going to conferences. Now, you know as well as I do, we do a lot more webinars now, though, right? And more people are saying, well, you don't need to go to a conference. You can go to a dozen sessions at webinars, and you get the content.
So yes and no. It's not a clear black and white, I would think. Yes, you can attend. You can get some knowledge. But there's a couple of things I think that happen when you're on a webinar, depending on how disciplined you are and how your organization operates. Mm-hmm. Typically, if you're on a webinar, you're at your desk, you're at your computer. So you're going to see your email thing ding up. Mm-hmm, and if that goes, you're going to click on it. You have people stop by. You have your phone there to interrupt. You have all these interruptions that could impact your ability to learn through that webinar. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Number two, not all webinars offer the ability to ask questions, ask for clarifications, or have a conversation with the guy sitting next to you about the topic to clarify something.
That's right. That's right.
And to me, if you want to learn something and take away it, you need to understand it and internalize it. And that may be having a conversation around a particular point to make sure it makes sense in your head the way you're thinking of it. It may be challenging something and having someone work through why it is the way it is mm-hmm, with you. Mm-hmm.
And you don't get that. And you do that at a live seminar. Now, some conferences, they say hold your questions to the end, which kind of stifles that a bit. But some presenters just say, hey, ask your questions. Let's do it right now. And then there's always the come up to the podium afterwards. And you see some of that in webinars with the chat and Q&A. But you're right. One of the things that you can do in a webinar, and it takes participants taking the initiative to go make it happen, plus the webinar host saying, you know, it's okay. Do go ahead and do that, is use that chat window and say, hey, does anybody else, you know, solve a problem that way? Or is there another way? Or that doesn't work here because we have a slightly different circumstance. What other solutions are there? And then other people can chime in. And I've seen that happen so effectively where there's a whole nother conversations or two or three conversations going on in the chat window. And to me, that's a sign of a successful webinar is it's, here's a group of people that care about a similar topic and they're talking about it. And at a conference, that's kind of discouraged. You don't sit there and talk to your neighbor loudly because it's hard to do both. Where chatting and writing versus listening to and watching slides, you can kind of keep track of both of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know what,
you're saying, though, that webinars aren't going to replace conferences, though. Why is that?
Because you don't get that interaction. You don't get that rapport building, that camaraderie. You don't establish that personal relationship.
Yeah, you don't have the chance for the beer after at the networking event.
Well, absolutely. That was, yeah.
That was it. That was the beer. That was it.
But you think of it. It's as much as we have this technology, we still want to interact with people. We still want to have meaningful conversations with people be able to do that openly and freely. And some people aren't comfortable with typing into a chat window. Also, sometimes you're missing a huge part of that communication there. So if you think of communication, I can't remember the percentage, but there's some percentage, but it's 80 or 90% of communication is visual through body language, only 10% is through what you're saying.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. Chat.
You don't get any of that through chat. Yeah. Right. So it's how do you establish that relationship? How do you build that rapport? It's very, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when there's kind of a bridge between the two, and I think you've been involved with them at some point, is the mastermind groups. So it's not as structured as a webinar where somebody's going to present something or talk about it, but it's aimed at a discussion, and it can be done live, right? You can all meet at the local coffee shop or a certain place and meet live and do it, or you can meet virtually. And it's not a webinar, it's not a conference, but it's a chance to find a safe place to talk about stuff and bring up issues or problems or challenges or objectives you have and get advice and get ideas and get suggestions.
Yeah. And I think that it's its own separate piece, and it's another vitally important piece of the puzzle to improving your network, to improving your knowledge and your ability. You have the conferences, you have the webinar, you have the mastermind, you have books, you have your informal mentors at work. You have all these things, right? And they all come together to give you the most realistic, practical opportunity for you to learn and progress in your profession. One thing only is not going to get you all the way there. You need a variety of these different pieces working together so you get the most out of it and can progress and gain the most knowledge as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, solve problems and make the world a better place. Oh, like it's a good summary. No, I guess we completely hijacked the topic we thought we were going to talk about. So I have to come up with a new title now. For listeners, and have you gone to, if you're in the asset management world, have you gone to a product development or product design type conference or vice versa? And, you know, what were your takeaways or thoughts on that? Or is it one conference a year and nothing else? Or are you with James and I that it's a mix of things and that help you influence your professional development? And so what works for you and what doesn't? You know, and the other thing, James, I'm interested in is maybe we should write down what our top five recommended conferences are. If you could only go to one conference this year, what would it be? Kind of thing, and see if maybe do a poll, see what the top conferences are.
One would be tough. I don't know if I could give you one.
Every time I talk to you, you're heading to a conference or coming back from one. So how many do you go to in a year? And I know it's part of your business. It's part of the marketing, but.
So this year it's only two. Next year I hope to do four.
Okay.
But it's, you got to pick and choose which one's going to provide the biggest value to you, right? Whether you're exhibiting or whether you're presenting a paper or whether you're attending to learn something, you never have limitless funds. So you have to be pragmatic and pick about what is the most important for you. There's a couple overseas ones that I would like to do, but you know, that comes with its own set of challenges.
That's right. Yeah.
Rams
is a big conference
That is one that I want to attend because it covers related, but different aspects of this topic that we discuss every week. So, but it's a matter of prioritizing it, making it happen. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this year it's in Reno, so I'm doing a tutorial at RAMS, and you're going to be just back. By the time this airs, you're going to be back from SMRP. So we'll have to get together again after you get back from that conference and do a recap of PMAC and SMRP and see how that goes. And I know Kirk Gray, another co-host on the show, is back from ASTR, Applied Stress Testing Reliability. I have no idea if that's what it stands for, but it's a 4-letter one. And they were in Austin and had a great time over recently. So we'll probably get a summary of that. But there are quite a few good conferences out there. And you're right. You got to pick and choose and find the ones that make sense and then invest in it, whether it's a webinar or a podcast or a mastermind group or developing a mentor. It's really up to the individual to get the most out of it, to actively go develop those relationships and the opportunities to learn and make that all happen.
Absolutely. I tell, when I present a paper, I always at the end of it close with, write down one thing that you learned in this presentation that you can apply next week in your organization when you get back.
That's right. Yeah. And do you have just them tell you? Thing. Do you have anybody come back to you and say they did that?
You know what? I've had one or two people come back
Great.
Say they've done that. The biggest thing though is, you know, you get trapped into the firefighting, back into your reactive day-to-day stuff. But if you take the time to write down that one thing that you can do next week based on the learnings, you have a plan and it's written down. You're more likely to follow that and execute that.
That's right.
So I've even gone through to take it one step further and say, what is the one thing you're going to do next week? And what is the one thing you're going to do the second week you're back?
That's right. That's right. String it out a little bit. But also, one course I went to they actually had us write down what we're going to do. And it was a daily practice kind of activity. And they said, we're going to check in. We're going to get on the phone. They did small groups of the class on the phone for half an hour and said, well, how's it going? Did it work? Did it not work? What were the troubles? And so if it worked, it was great. We all celebrated. If it didn't work, they said, well, why? What's holding you back? And it was a chance to provide a little education or, clear up any uncertainties or help us figure out a strategy to get through the roadblock or whatever. And they did it three times every 2 weeks of over 6 week period to reinforce that you actually took something out of the class. And I thought it was brilliant. And we don't do that in conferences, right? That's a huge overhead. And that was built into the class that I did. But it's the idea that you do is have people write it down and reinforce it. It certainly improves the chance that they'll take something away and do something different out of it. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Now, good stuff. All right. Well, James, I think I've already mentioned that you're going to be at SMRP. Unfortunately, I think this episode will come out after that. But so we'll be in the throes of winter. You're going to be shoveling snow up there in the Great White North, and I'll be on the beach down here in sunny California. So any other big plans as you head into the winter months?
No, not at the moment. Right now, it's just getting through this stuff here and
and plan for next year's sequences and stuff. All right. Well,
exactly.
I'll be back with you. I'll probably do that. I'll ping you for a show note of, your recommendation, and then we'll do a poll on the show notes of, what's your one recommendation. And
Perfect. And
see what we get out of that. So anyway, as you're listening to this, go to reliability.fm. You can find Speaking of Reliability. And I have no idea what episode number this will be, but if you're listening to it, you should certainly be able to find it online there. And we'll make it obvious where the poll is. We'll put it in a couple of places. But as we get near the end of 2017, a lot of people are looking at what conferences are available and what they want to do next year. So it may be a good idea to poll everybody and say, hey, what do you recommend? We've got a lot of really smart listeners to the podcast. The comments and feedback we get, James, is pretty good. I'd say erudite. It's an erudite group. And I think I'm using the right word. But anyway, we'll see how that works. Good talking to you, James. Talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Fred.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett of Apex Ridge Reliability. I want to invite you to take a look and get a copy of 50 Ways to Improve Product Reliability. It's a reliability book created for a broad audience on how to incorporate reliability tools and methods in the product development program. To get a copy, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/50ways. That's 50WAYS.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.